students from Boscobel and Berlin High School. The Boscobel students, please stand so we can see them. The Berlin, thank you, you may be seated. The Berlin High School students, would they stand, please? Thank you, and you may be seated. As you all know, you are here with the Court with Class program that is run by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. You've been given materials on the case you're about to hear. And at noon, you will join with the Albany High School students who were here at the prior case. And you will talk with retired Chief Justice Roland Day. So if you all will stay after this argument, and Justice Day will meet with you, and you will be joined by others. Now that we have met you, I would like to introduce the court to you. On my far left is our newest Justice, Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. To his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, we did have this morning, and I don't know if you're still with us, public defenders from the country of Israel. Yes, I see Mr. Mann here. Would they please stand? Good. When we welcome you again, you may be seated, and the court will have lunch with the Israeli public defenders and some of our public defenders and Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General. The Israeli public defenders are here and are studying with the Wisconsin Public Defender's Office. And some Wisconsin public defenders have visited in Israel. So our second case is 98-1456-CR State v. Kittelstadt. And representing the defendant, Mr. Kittelstadt, is Richard L. Wachowski. How badly did I mispronounce your name?
It's Wachowski.
Okay.
I've heard it before.
Okay.
Hey, please, the court. The issues here today are twofold, but they're actually one issue, whether or not the allegations made against the defendant at a preliminary examination constitute the offenses of soliciting prostitution and extortion. This case arose, as the court is aware, on an interlocutory appeal from a bind-over decision at a preliminary examination. The first issue is whether or not the defendant's alleged activity constitutes a violation of 943.30(1), the extortion statute. The defendant is alleged to have threatened that if one of the exchange students that he was sponsoring would not bring a girl home and have sex with her, that he would withdraw his sponsorship of the educational opportunity that the student had. 943.30(1) specifically prohibits threatening to commit injury to a person, property, business, profession, calling, or trade. There's nothing in that statute that makes reference to educational pursuits, an educational program, or anything of that nature. It's the defendant's position that, in fact, in the absence of such explicit prohibition, that the activity here does not fit within the context of that statute. The second issue is whether or not the defendant's proposed activity constitutes soliciting prostitution. As the court is aware, the allegations are that the defendant told the exchange students that he was sponsoring that he would provide them with money if they would bring girls home and have sex with them so that he could observe. There was no allegation that there would be any kind of knowing commercial transaction between the young man and the young woman they were supposed to bring home. In addition, there are no indications that, in fact, any of this activity actually took place. The statute that defines prostitution within the state of Wisconsin says specifically that prostitution involves having sex or offering to have sex, and that something of value is given for that act or offer. That did not occur here. The solicitation to commit prostitution statute 944.32 penalizes one who leads another into the practice of prostitution. Unlike every other solicitation offense in the state of Wisconsin, which requires that the underlying offense be a felony, soliciting prostitution involves the solicitation of a misdemeanor offense. The real issue here is whether or not there was any prostitution actually involved. The position of the defendant is that prostitution requires that there be a commercial transaction wherein there is the exchange of money for sexual activity, and that didn't really occur here. This court has previously addressed what the purpose of the soliciting prostitution statute is in Sears versus State. This court has said in that case that the legislative history of that statute indicates that the prostitution statute was intended to deal with commercial vice. Here we're dealing with a situation where there's an offer to give money to someone if they would have sex that would not be commercial in nature. The other party would not be aware of any commercial aspect of the transaction, and there would be no exchange of any consideration between the parties who would actually be involved in the sexual activity.
Counsel, assuming that the person that Mr. Kittlestad approached, one of the boys, did this, accepted the money, would that in fact be a prostitute? Would he be guilty of prostitution? Not Mr. Kittlestad, but the boy.
I think under an expansive reading of the statute as urged by the state, it would be arguable, but it would still be our position that the commercial transaction has to involve the knowing acquiescence of both parties involved in the sexual activity in the commercial nature of the transaction. And given that interpretation and reading, it would be our position that it wouldn't be prostitution because the other party, the female he would be having sex with, would have no knowledge of any kind of commercial aspect.
Well, suppose somebody had, somebody gives a prostitute money to have sex with Mr. A. Mr. A thinks this is a matter of love. And would that be soliciting prostitution by anybody here?
Well, and again, Mr. A would be lacking knowledge of any type of commercial transaction. Mr. A wouldn't be aware of the fact that there was any kind of exchange of consideration for any sexual activity. I think that arguably it could be said that the person offering money might be guilty of being a party to the crime of prostitution, but it's not solicitation of prostitution because solicitation of prostitution is meant to prohibit the entry or urging of entry into someone into the practice or life of prostitution, and that's not really the situation here or in that scenario.
I thought that the Court of Appeals said you conceded that there was solicitation, but that there was no prostitution.
For purposes of the appeal here, Your Honor, we concede, since we have to concede that the facts adduced at the preliminary examination are true given the format within which this appeal took place, that solicitation did occur. As the court is aware, solicitation just means that you urge or offer or cajole or take any kind of action to attempt to persuade somebody to do something. Given the facts adduced at the preliminary examination, we concede that, in fact, the testimony established that there was an attempt to cajole, persuade, or have someone involved in the activity, not conceding that the activity is prostitution.
So, solicit, that there wasn't, you conceded with the activity was intentional on the part of the defendant.
For purposes of this proceeding,
right.
Yes.
And you concede that it was solicits under the statute.
Correct.
For purposes of this proceeding. And but you say it didn't solicit to practice prostitution. So that the key words for you, I thought, but don't let me put words in your mouth, were practice prostitution.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's, again, our position that it requires some degree of knowing commercial transaction between the parties involved in the behavior in the actual sexual content.
Suppose he had only done this once with one male. Would that be sufficient to be practice?
No, Your Honor, because the case law that's cited in the brief sets forth that it has to be a continuing activity. One particular incident would not constitute soliciting prostitution. I think that goes to the intent of the statute, which is to prevent someone from bringing an individual into a life of prostitution, into the profession of prostitution, into the practice of prostitution.
So it's your position, if I get it correctly, that in order to amount to prostitution, there has to be a knowledge on the part of both people involved in the sexual contact.
Yes, Your Honor, that is our position. And if we look at the statute that was the precursor of the present prostitution statute, although it was admittedly very gender biased and only applied to situations where specific reference was made to a female engaged in unwholesome or illicit activity, the obvious format within which that statute was presented was that the parties involved would know that there was an exchange of sex for money. That's what prostitution is.
What about a pimp?
A pimp is soliciting prostitution if, in fact, he is engaged in cajoling, persuading, or in other ways getting an individual to be involved in prostitution. And certainly a pimp would have...
Could a pimp be prosecuted under this statute?
I believe so. But again, we'd be...
Well, isn't your client's actions very much akin to being a pimp?
Because in a situation involving a pimp, both parties to the actual sexual transaction are aware of the fact that it's a commercial transaction. There's a prostitute who the pimp is actually acting as an agent for, who's aware of the commercial nature of the transaction, and then there's the customer, who obviously is aware of the commercial nature of the transaction because the customer is paying for the services being rendered.
It seems to me, counsel, that we're blending or blurring here. Let me step back. You concede for purposes of this appeal that there was solicitation. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So then I want to focus on the definition of prostitution. This is what Justice Babbage was doing. If there is an individual who hires a veteran prostitute to have sex with this business client. The businessman hires the veteran prostitute to have sex with a third party, the client. And much like the hypothetical of the chief, the client doesn't know that this is a veteran prostitute. He thinks it's affection. Is that prostitution? I'm focusing not on solicitation, but prostitution. Is that veteran prostitute engaging in prostitution?
I think the prostitute is. I would argue that, in fact, the businessman who's unaware of the commercial nature of the transaction is not.
Okay. Well, I'm talking about the definitions. So for a definition of prostitution, you don't need both people engaged in a two-part act to know that something, so that money is exchanged. Is that correct?
That would be correct if we're limiting our question to just prostitution, not soliciting prostitution.
Well, again, that's why I started. I understand that you have conceded solicitation in this case for purposes of...
For clarification, we concede the element of solicitation, given the nature of what solicitation is defined as. But the issue is whether or not the solicitation was for purposes of prostitution. And again, because of the unique nature of soliciting prostitution as being a felony offense with a specific purpose, which is to prevent the entry of people into the world of prostitution, it's treated differently than just solicitation to commit a crime, which, as the court is aware, requires that the underlying crime be a felony.
Okay.
And applies to any crime.
How can you answer Justice Bradley that the prostitute who has been hired is engaged in prostitution when it seems to be the basis of the fundamental position you're taking is that both people have to know that there's a commercial transaction that are engaged in the sexual contact? Those two positions don't seem to square at all. I mean, because if the prostitute that is hired by this businessman to have sex with a third party, and the third party doesn't know that it's commercial, but believes it's simply an act of affection, what's happened to your theory?
Then the question is whether or not the individual being charged, the prostitute in that particular case, is aware of that there's a commercial transaction.
But in this case, Mr. Kittlestad is aware that there's a commercial transaction.
But he's not one of the parties to the actual sexual act that would constitute the prostitution.
But counsel, in response to my question that raised this, you said he could be charged as a party to the crime. And there are three ways, I gather, that he could be a party to a crime. And it doesn't matter which way, you're liable.
Your Honor, I indicated that a pimp could be charged as a party to the crime. Because the pimp would actually be involved in the business, would be aware of the commercial.
How is Mr. Kittlestad anything other than a pimp?
Because all he is doing is he's offering an individual who's not involved in the trade of prostitution a sum of money to have sex with another individual. There would be
so
no...
It's a defense to prostitution if you're not engaged in the trade but only do it once in a while?
No, but it's a defense to whether or not it's soliciting prostitution. Because soliciting prostitution requires an ongoing activity. And again, what's necessary is to look at the specific purpose of the statute in question, which this court has indicated in both Sears and in the Huff case, which is to prevent an individual from bringing someone into the business of prostitution, a life of prostitution, into preventing someone from becoming a prostitute. And that's not the situation we have here.
Why isn't the male, and in this case none of the males complied with this request, why isn't the male the prostitute then?
Well, obviously in this situation because they didn't engage in any activity.
No, but had he?
Had he engaged in that activity, it could be argued that, in fact, if he was charged with prostitution, it could be argued that because of his knowing involvement in the sexual activity and his receipt of consideration for that involvement, that he could be involved in prostitution. But again, we have to separate the concept of soliciting prostitution from prostitution itself, because they have very different objectives and very different types of activity that are being attempted to be censured.
I don't know why you say that. The statute says whoever intentionally solicits any person to practice prostitution, or any person who intentionally causes any person to practice prostitution. What difference does it make? One time, several times, no time?
Well, in regard to one time or several times, that specific issue was addressed in the Johnson case. And in that case, the court indicated that a one-time situation would not be soliciting prostitution because the practice of prostitution requires more than one time an ongoing activity. And that's how they differentiated prostitution from soliciting prostitution. But again, it's necessary to look at what the reason for the soliciting prostitution statute is, what the underlying activity meant to be banned is, and that's bringing someone into the practice of prostitution. It's necessary to separate to some degree the soliciting prostitution statute from the prostitution statute itself to see whether or not it was the legislature's intent that the soliciting prostitution statute would apply to a factual scenario.
Are you saying that one act of a sexual relationship, one act for money, does not constitute prostitution?
No, it does, but soliciting someone to engage in one act of sex doesn't constitute soliciting prostitution. And the court has held that in the Johnson case. Because it refers to practice of prostitution.
The defendant here, though, was doing this for his own sexual enjoyment. I mean, the state makes that point that he was paying money to someone else to engage in, and therefore, whether you call it voyeurism or, but it obviously for his own sexual enjoyment, why would that fall under the 944.30 definition?
Because the specific definition of what constitutes prostitution doesn't include voyeurism or watching. It requires, in fact, it sets forth specifically those acts which form the basis for prostitution, those acts being non-marital sexual intercourse, oral or anal sex, masturbation, or an act of sexual contact. So the prostitution statute itself would not cover voyeurism or watching someone.
What do you additional staff have been appropriately charged with being a party to the crime?
I think that that may have been a more defensible charge than soliciting prostitution, because if in fact it would be found that the young man who he would offer money to would potentially be guilty of prostitution or engaged in prostitution, the offering of money to have him do that could be construed to be being a party to the crime. One of the problems here with the state's theory is that the offering of money, which is a component or an element of prostitution, is actually the component which constitutes the solicitation. So the exchange of money here is alleged to have occurred between the defendant and the young men who he solicited, whereas there would be no exchange of money between the actual parties engaged in any sexual activity prohibited by the statute.
It isn't just money, though, counsel. Isn't it the statute referred to anything of value?
That's correct, Your Honor. But in this particular case, the only thing being talked about is money.
We talked about reduction of the bills and things of that also, right?
And that could be construed as to be a form of monetary payment, I guess. But, it's still a financial...
Reducing phone bills or something.
Which would be a forgiveness of financial obligation.
Refresh my recollection, if you will, on the issue of ongoing practice. Was it five young men that apparently were involved?
There were five young men who testified at the preliminary hearing that the offers of that nature were made to them.
And was there an indication of how, I'm getting to the ongoingness issue. How's that for a word? Is there any indication of the record of these five who had offers? What kind of number are we talking about?
Number of offers?
Offers, yes.
That wasn't set forth with any specificity. Again, this arose out of the preliminary examination, so the record is relatively sparse in that regard.
Is there a range at all? I mean, I suppose we can assume, tell me if I'm wrong, that at least there were five offers made with five people testifying that offers had been made to them at least once.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Would five constitute a practice of prostitution?
I believe that under the court's opinion in Johnson, in which that issue was addressed, that it would.
Now, in Johnson, was he convicted or not convicted?
In Johnson, the court, there was an issue there that was raised by the defendant as to whether or not there was selective prosecution involved. And in that particular case, the court was asked to address the ongoing nature. In that case, I believe there was only one incident that was involved, and the court found that, in fact, that didn't constitute a practice of prostitution.
It therefore, did or did not?
Did not. One incident.
But here we have
convicted. Who was convicted?
In Johnson, if I'm reading the right Johnson case, State v. Johnson, 108 U.S. 2nd 703 Court of Appeals, 1982.
That's the second Johnson case, Your Honor.
Okay.
The first Johnson case is Johnson versus State.
But in the second case, he was convicted of a single act.
That's correct. That was a different defendant, obviously, in a different case. And I don't believe that's the case in which the ongoing nature of the activity was the specific issue to be addressed.
I think that it was. It was an intentional solicitation case, and he solicited one woman. So I'll go back and look at the other Johnson case.
Are you sure, counsel?
I mean, my sense is the 108 with second case is the case you're really talking about.
That's the one where the defendant had brought an individual in to be photographed. Because
that's
of
right.
Her potentiality as a model.
That's right. And then after he photographs her, he suggests that she could make more money being a prostitute than she could make being photographed.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in that case,
they convicted him.
The factual circumstances were that he had made an offer that if she engaged in, and the way he expressed it to her was, if she would be willing to engage in sexual activity with other individuals, that she could make more money. And in effect, that was an inquiry as to whether or not she'd be interested in a pattern of behavior in that respect. Even though the underlying contact was only a single contact, there were discussions regarding a pattern of contact. Again, you know, we stress the fact that this court has stated before what the purpose of the soliciting prostitution statute is. And it's our position that in this particular case, because of the nature of the actual sexual activity that would occur, the lack of a knowing commercial transaction involving the exchange of sexual favors for anything of value, that it did not constitute soliciting prostitution because there would be no life of prostitution being entered into and no practice of prostitution being entered into.
Could you speak to the extortion charge?
I think that the issue there is the interpretation of the statute. As we've indicated, the statute prohibits specifically committing injury to the person, property, business, profession, calling, or trade of another. And here, the only allegation was that one of the exchange students said that the defendant told him that if he didn't comply with his request to bring girls home to have sex with them, that he would withdraw his sponsorship of him at the technical college, an injury to his educational pursuit. The statute does not specifically refer to educational pursuits. As the justice is aware, the Court of Appeals held that calling is a more inclusive term that also includes educational pursuits. It's our position that a strict interpretation of the statute and looking at the specific items in the statute that are prohibited from being threatened do not include anything of an educational nature, and therefore a reading of the statute and the specific elements of the statute would not include that.
Mr. Kittle, or Reverend Kittlestad, charge rent?
No.
He provided that for nothing?
That was part of his sponsorship arrangement.
So, if people were thrown out of his home, they would have to pay money, is that right? For other lodging.
Theoretically, that would happen, but as the court is aware, that didn't happen. No one was removed or made to leave.
But would it be fair to say that he threatened that that would happen?
The only allegation at the preliminary examination is that he threatened to withdraw his sponsorship of their educational behavior. There are no indications that he threatened to have them leave the house or to infringe upon any financial aspects of their existence.
Well, didn't he put Mr. Sedano's property out in the lawn or something?
There was some discussion about him doing that at one point, but again, assuming the accuracy of the allegations, which we have to do at this time, there was never any attempt by Mr. Kittlestad or any movement by him to actually remove Mr. Sedano from the home, except that alleged demonstration of disfavor on his part.
How do you get around the language in the Huff case, which indicates the focus is on the recruiter or the solicitor and does not hinge on whether the solicitor wants the recruit to have sex with some third party? And this was quoted in your briefs, I think, so you know what I'm talking about. How do you get around that language in Huff, if you can? And if you can't, does that mean we have to overrule that discussion or withdraw that discussion in Huff?
That discussion in Huff, Your Honor, was part of an overall discussion as to the nature of prostitution and solicitation of prostitution. And the justice said, may be aware that was in the context where the Huff court said that a logical reading of the prostitution statute is that prostitution includes situations where a person asks another to provide sexual services to himself or herself for a fee. And as this statute's emphasis is to curtail the recruitment of males and females into the practice of providing sex for a fee. I think that the discussion in Huff that you made reference to includes an overall discussion of what actually is prohibited by the statute, that again, the purpose of the statute is to preclude someone from being lured or forced into a life of prostitution.
But it gets to that language of whether or not it's two people or three people doesn't alter our analysis, but your argument is that it only can be two people.
Well, I think that language in Huff refers to the factual circumstances in Huff where the issue was whether or not prostitution or soliciting prostitution required that a third party be involved or that the sexual activity contemplated only be between the defendant charged with soliciting and a particular individual. So I don't think it really impacts the question as to whether or not soliciting prostitution requires a knowing commercial transaction. It just indicates that that commercial transaction can involve only two people instead of three people. But it still requires that they all be aware of the commercial nature of the transaction.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General, representing this state.
May it please the court. Throughout the proceedings in this action, counsel for the petitioner has argued in his brief and now before this court that there was no prostitute involved here. There was no commercial activity involved here. There must be knowledge on the parties engaged in the sex act in order for the petitioner to be guilty, etc., etc. You can say that 100 times or 1,000 times. That does not necessarily make it true. In fact, it's always good to begin at the beginning. And the beginning here is the plain language of the two statutes that we are primarily concerned with. The prostitution and soliciting prostitution statutes. One solicits prostitution when he, this would be Mr. Kittlestand, intentionally solicits or causes any person to practice prostitution. The obvious question becomes, what is prostitution? Pertinent to this case is charged, 944.30(1) applies, and that is any person who intentionally has or offers to have or requests to have non-marital sexual intercourse or anything of value. Mr. Kittle said, in essence, tried to coerce these young men to become prostitutes. He coerced them to go out and request sexual intercourse with females who admittedly would be unwitting in this whole venture, but to bring them home for something of value. He encouraged them to commit crimes. He encouraged them to commit crimes that they would not otherwise commit. Counsel for the petitioner talks about the Sears, this court's decision in the Sears case as if that backs up his position. When we're construing statutes, whether we're looking at the plain language of an unambiguous statute or we're looking at an ambiguous statute, we look to find what is the intent of the legislature. With respect to the solicitation statute, this court was clear in Sears what the legislative intent was. I'll quote, "The solicitation statute represents a means of protecting those who would otherwise not commit crimes without the encouragement of another." The word prostitute, hooker, John does not appear in that quote. The intent was those who, protecting those who otherwise would not commit crimes, would include these young men from Panama who would otherwise not commit these crimes but for the encouragement of Mr. Kittlestead. That is what we're about here. Yes, it is confusing. Things are being blurred here. When are we talking about solicitation? When are we talking about prostitution? But when you start with the plain language and you look at the intent of the legislature as this court set forth in Sears, and you look at how it's been applied by the Court of Appeals in the Huff case and the Johnson case, it is plain. It is plain as day that this conduct falls within 944.32 and 944.30. Sure, it's on the outer limits of the statute. It's unusual.
Well, let's just double back for a moment. Who is committing prostitution here?
Now, in this case, and I think this is similar to the example you queried Mr. Wachowski about, where one of the parties knows that there's a business transaction involved here and one of the parties doesn't. He had these young men follow through on this request, they would be engaging in an act of prostitution. They would be requesting and encouraging these women to come home because they knew they would be paid if they did so.
So it's the, had this gone according to the defendant's plan, the young men, the Panamanian men, would have been the ones committing prostitution.
Yes.
Not the defendant in this case.
Now, I think, and that question came up, it's a good question, and I think he probably could, had the act been completed, he probably could be charged under 939.05 with party to the crime of prostitution. Because he aids and abets, encourages, conspires, whichever theory you want to use. He's not a direct actor because he's a voyeur here. He's not, as opposed to the menage a trois situation where he would be a direct actor, but he is definitely a party had this act been completed.
Okay.
Now, one might ask, well, why didn't they charge him with that? Well, because the act wasn't completed here. So we go to the solicitation statute. And as interpreted, the solicitation statute requires ongoing activity, a solicitation of ongoing activity, so one act won't do, at least as it has been interpreted by the Court of Appeals, well, and by this court as well, but I think that Sears and then the Court of Appeals decisions in Johnson and Huff make it plain that we're talking about a solicitation of ongoing conduct. And of course, the classic example is the pimp situation. The classic example is, I want you to work for me, and I get a cut of the action, and I'm not interested in engaging in any activity, but I'm doing it for monetary gain. The difference between that situation and this situation is not so much the conduct. He is soliciting these young men to engage in multiple acts of sexual conduct. The difference is his motive. His motive is not financial gain, it is his own sexual gratification. But I see nothing in the case law that makes that distinction, that if it's purely for, if you solicit someone to engage in a practice of prostitution purely for your own sexual gratification, that you are not guilty, but if you do it for your own financial benefit, you are guilty. And certainly in this case, where there is a commercial aspect to it, regardless of what his motives are, where he is the one providing the money, that we are talking about both situations. Here we're talking about something that would, on his end, is motivated by his sexual gratification, and on the quote-unquote prostitute's end, would be motivated by financial gain. Or
I'll close the counsel, and I ask that question about his own sexual enjoyment, indicating that no, that cannot be. Do you think the fact that he is offering, you've got both here, He creates a situation, he offers the money to get somebody to do something, and the satisfaction would bring this within the statute. You indicate that in your brief, but I'm still having trouble just trying to go through the analysis of how that would bring Mr. Kittle's debt in.
Yeah, and it's a little confusing, but I think what it really boils down to here is how broad is the prostitution statute. And again, the statute says whoever engages, under sub 1, whoever engages in non-marital sexual intercourse for anything of value is guilty. It doesn't say whoever receives anything of value from his sexual partner is guilty. It is engaging in sexual activity for anything of value from somewhere, that he engaged in that activity because someone is paying him, or she engaged in that activity because someone is paying her. The classic example, obviously, there is the John and the hooker. But this language does not limit it to that situation.
Are you reading from sub 1?
Yes.
Well, the language is, has or offers to have or requests to have non-marital sexual intercourse for anything of value. The defendant, as I understand the facts, did not have or offer to have or request to have non-marital sexual intercourse.
Correct.
So, I mean,
he wanted
were you suggesting that he could have been charged?
He solicited the young men to do
that. Yeah, okay. Maybe I misunderstood. You're not suggesting that the defendant could be charged with prostitution?
No.
Okay.
Only if the act had been completed by one of these boys, and then he'd arguably could be charged under 93905 as a part of it.
What I wanted to follow up on was something that's always caused me concern in this case. And that is what arguably is broad language in the Court of Appeals opinion. Page 6 says, of the slip opinion, as long as someone compensates another for engaging in non-marital sex, the elements of prostitution are met. That's pretty broad. The classic example is the movie producer and porno films. Are all movie producers of porno films subject to being charged with solicitation for prostitution?
Solicitation? Well, if
they
it's hire, ongoing
I'm saying
activity,
the producer is going to be hiring the actors. Maybe producers don't hire
arguably
actors.
Arguably, yes. If it's ongoing activity and he's paying them to engage in sexual intercourse, I think arguably that would fit.
I mean, my sense is not only arguably from what you are advancing, it fits on all fours. You're hiring, this great man and this great woman on a continuous basis so I can run this movie reel and make porno films. And I'm paying them money. I'm paying them to have non-marital sex on an ongoing basis. I would assume, absolutely, under your definition, that the producer who hires these actors on an ongoing basis can be charged and convicted of soliciting for prostitution.
And frankly, I don't know why that's any all that different from the classic pimp situation. They're clearly subject to the statute. I think, let's put it this way, that producer is assuming a great risk if he engages in that activity and could very well be charged because...
Are pornographical films contrary to the law, or are they protected at least among adults under the First Amendment?
Well, the films themselves obviously implicate First Amendment issues. But we're talking about the activity.
I know, but you can't make the film if you don't allow the activity. So you got a First Amendment potential.
Well, I suppose there's potentially a First Amendment Act issue involved. On the other hand, prostitution is the oldest profession. It also is one of the oldest crimes. And that might be one of the crimes that would withstand a First Amendment challenge, but that is neither here nor there because that clearly is not an issue in this case. The way I understand the petitioner's position is that the thing of value has to be exchanged between the two parties to the sex act. And I ask you to look at these two statutes together and see where it says that, because I don't see it. The important thing, again, as the case law points out, we look at the state of the mind of the solicitor, not of the people engaged in the sex act. We look at the exchange of sex for a thing of value. It is, the important thing is receipt of a thing of value in order to engage in this activity. Normally, yes, it comes from the other participant, but not always. And this is a case where it doesn't. It comes from a third party.
Counsel.
And, yes.
I'm still bothered by the breadth of the argument and application here. I can talk about porno films, and we can say, oh, porno films are bad, so... Let's take something that that happens, I think, day in and day out on television and very popular movies, not necessarily porno films. That is, prostitution is defined as not just intercourse, but sexual contact. It seems like it's hard to go to the movie unless you're going to Disney without there being in most movies, and I feel comfortable in saying most movies, sexual actors engaging in sexual contact. And I think that's probably true on a lot of the TV that's shown nightly, actors engaging in sexual contact. Are the producers of As the World Turns, if that's still on TV, can they be charged with soliciting for prostitution? And can the producers of, that's a popular movie you went to recently, but something that's, you know, that's PG-14, 13, PG-13, whether sexual contact, is that producer guilty of soliciting for prostitution?
Well, I think
because someone touched a breast in the movie.
Well, I think at that point you are getting close to First Amendment issues. On the other hand, I think you get into the you get into questions of intent and cause and consent, and I think you can take just about any criminal statute and find an absurd situation, and that would be close to the absurd situation.
It would be absurd to charge the producers after it's absurd because it's happening all the time, so that's not absurd. The movies and television programs are on every night, I think. So it would be absurd to charge a producer yourself.
Well, I mean, I suppose there might be a prosecutor out there who would risk life and limb and do that. On the other hand, he would be facing a tough First Amendment battle, and it would be a tough case to prove. I think we're looking for extremes that certainly aren't present in this case. And I think that's the important thing.
I'm looking for extremes to test the proposition of the Court of Appeals opinion to see that the language is too broad. Is the language too broad in the Court of Appeals opinion?
Well, I don't think it is, because I think it jives with the language of the statute. Now, maybe the legislature was wrong in enacting statutes that are that broad. Maybe we are pushing constitutional limits when we get into that situation. Maybe there are due process questions. The fact remains that in the classic Hooker and John situation, and in this situation, it is clear that the conduct involved is illegal, that these young men were to engage in, to bring women back and be paid for it. Here, that is a lot closer to the classic situation, I believe, than it is to the Hollywood producer. And you, again, we focus on the intent of the solicitor. We focus on the fact that one of these parties to this activity engaged or received money, and there's no distinction between two parties and three parties, because in the Huff case is clear on that point that. In fact, the Huff was the reverse situation of this, where the defendant in Huff argued, the defendant was charged with, I believe it was soliciting prostitution, where he was one of the two participants. And he encouraged ongoing sexual activity with, he was party A, and he encouraged ongoing sexual activity between himself and party B. And he said, the solicitation statute only applies to the three-party situation where one party, party A, hires party B to have sex with party C. And that the cases historically have gone that way. Then Huff expanded the statute to include not only the three-party situation, the pimp sort of situation, if you will, but also the two-party situation if you have the ongoing activity that is required in the solicitation statute.
And under both Huff and Johnson, you don't have to actually have anybody engage in prostitution.
That's correct.
So here, no one engaged in prostitution.
Yes, it is similar to the in-court crime of solicitation under 939-31, where it's the act of solicitation that renders you guilty, not necessarily that it succeeded. And, you know, again, I think we have to focus on the plain language of the statute. And yes, the statute is broad, and yes, because of the breadth, there is the potential in the future in something of a prosecution that might push constitutional limits.
And Johnson did challenge this as being overly broad.
No, I think it was an equal protection challenge, if I recall. I might be confusing my cases.
Vague or overbroad, that's Johnson.
Yeah.
Could I press the argument, Mr. O'Brien? Suppose I said to one of the students here, I will lend you my car if you come back and tell me about your sexual exploits. Is that prostitution?
No, because I don't see where he's encouraging them to engage in sexual activity that they would not otherwise engage in. Yes, the car is a thing of value. I think you could argue that. But I don't see the encouragement. Now, if he said, now go out and have sex with someone and then come back with and tell me all about it, that's closer. But your example, it sounds as if he just wants to hear about what it is this young man's going to do, regardless of whether he's involved in it or not. You know, tell me all about your girlfriend or something. I think that's different than this situation where, as in the Sears case, these people are encouraged to engage in something they wouldn't otherwise engage in. And that's what the solicitor does. The solicitor is guilty because he is making people engage in criminal activity, whether it's soliciting prostitution, whether it's soliciting murder, as in the Yee case, which is, by the way, another third-party case under 939-31, where Party A solicited Party B to kill Party C. And that was held. The argument was, the defense argument was it had to be solicitation of A to kill B, otherwise it's not solicitation. And the court rejected that outright and said, no, we're not limited to a two-party situation. So that's the long answer to that question. With respect to the extortion, I think I just need to clear up a fact here. I think it was Justice Prosser asked about, you know, what did he actually threaten this young man with, Mr. Cedeno? And I'm looking at pages 62 and 63 of the prelim transcript where the young man testifies quite clearly that if he did not bring these girls back to have sex, that he would have him kicked out of the house and have him sent back to Panama. He would do whatever he could to have me sent back to Panama. So, I mean, that's a threat. I mean, we've got two things. You're going to get kicked out of the house, number one. So that's going to make things really tough on your ability to continue education. Number two, I'm going to do everything I can to get you out of the country. And so I think I just wanted to clarify that factual point because I think there was some confusion there.
Counsel, is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision that you would change?
I don't believe so. I think the Court of Appeals correctly interpreted these statutes. I think they analyzed the plain language of the statute. And now I'm talking about both the two prostitution statutes and the extortion statute. They considered, as they could, the common and approved dictionary usages of some of the salient terms. They considered the relevant case law. And I understand that Justice Bradley believes that the language is too broad, but frankly, I don't know how you narrow it. And I think the important point, at least with respect to this case, is that these facts clearly fit well within that statute and don't present any sort of constitutional issues. Another point to be made, I think we have to remember, too, as far as the facts of this case, we are only at the preliminary hearing stage. if this court affirms this, will go back for trial, and all of these issues can be hashed out. These issues of fact as to, you know, whether this was a real threat, whether he was serious when he suggested that they have multiple acts of sexual intercourse in his presence, whether they felt coerced, whether this really impacted on their education. I mean, those are all fact issues for the jury. I think the important point is that there was enough evidence adduced at the preliminary hearing for the Bindover judge to conclude that the case should continue to trial. And that's all we're about here. And then the question is, do those facts, as a matter of law, fit within the broad range of these two statutes? And again, it's the state's position that they do. Another question, too, is whether it's not clear from the briefs of Mr. Kittlestead whether he's claiming these statutes are ambiguous or unambiguous. And I assume he's claiming that they are ambiguous, and yet he points to nothing other than conjecture that these statutes are limited to the two-party John Hooker situation. And again, I think the Court of Appeals was correct in saying these are unambiguous. The plain language of these statutes clearly governs this sort of conduct, and at this point, at least, the case should proceed to trial so that all these issues of fact can be hashed out before a jury. There are no more questions, so I'll conclude my argument.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Counsel?
If, in fact, the extortion statute is unambiguous, then the factual circumstances here don't fit within the definition of the statute, because there's nothing in there that says anything about educational pursuits. In regard to the soliciting prostitution statute, I begin to direct the court to the specific language of 944.32, which says that whoever intentionally solicits or causes any person to practice prostitution or establishes any person in a place of prostitution is guilty of a Class B felony. The court in Sears v. State said that the legislative history indicates that the prostitution statute was intended to deal with commercial vice. The Court of Appeals in State v. McCollum in 1990, addressing again an equal protection argument, stated that the plain language of 944.30, the prostitution statute, makes criminal various acts of sexual gratification between two parties for anything of value, regardless of whether the party involved is payor or payee. All the cases that have interpreted Wisconsin statutes prohibiting both prostitution and soliciting prostitution have involved situations where all of the parties were knowledgeable about the commercial aspects of the transaction. Mr. O'Brien indicates that what's prohibited is having someone do something that they wouldn't engage in otherwise. What the defendant is accused of doing is urging these young men to engage in sexual activity. No indication that, in fact, they would engage in such activity otherwise. I should just clarify one thing in response to a question from Justice Bradley. I acknowledge that five acts of sexual contact would involve ongoing activity. However, in this particular situation, we're talking about five different individuals. The focus has to be on whether or not each one of them would have been urged to engage in the practice of prostitution. It's our position that there was not evidence of that. Five separate acts by five separate individuals are just that, five separate acts, not an ongoing practice of prostitution. The statute should be applied so as to prohibit commercialized sex. The language of the Court of Appeals goes well beyond that and would cause some degree of concern. If commercialized sex requires the knowing involvement of the parties to the transaction, that they be aware that it constitutes prostitution, the exchange of sex for something of value, that language in the Court of Appeals decision is much too broad, and if that is the interpretation of what constitutes soliciting prostitution, it also doesn't apply to this case. No one is being dragged or persuaded to engage in a life of prostitution. Wasn't being dragged or persuaded into frequenting or being a party to a place of prostitution. What we're talking about here is an individual who offered sums of money to individuals who involved in having consensual sex of a non-commercial nature. That's beyond the scope of what that statute was intended to prohibit, and therefore is not applicable to this particular fact situation.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes our hearing in 98-1456-CR. With that, the students shall remain. Our Israeli guests should proceed through this door, and we will take you up the elevator to the third floor conference room.